Here for the Lowe's early Black Friday deals? You're right on time for some of our biggest savings. We're talking up to 50% off select major appliances, plus up to an extra 25% off when you bundle select major appliances. Holiday lights going up soon? Select ladders are up to 50% off right now. Get Black Friday prices without the Black Friday crowds. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 11/19. Selection varies by location. Select locations only. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Welcome to another episode of The Good Listening To Show, your life and times with me, Chris Grimes, the storytelling show that features The Clearing, where all good questions come to get asked and all good stories come to be told, and where all my guests have two things in common. They're all creative individuals and all with an interesting story to tell. There are some lovely storytelling metaphors. A clearing, a tree, a juicy storytelling exercise called 5-4-3-2-1, some alchemy, some gold, a cheeky bit of Shakespeare, and a cake. So it's all to play for. So yes, welcome to The Good Listening To Show, your life and times with me, Chris Grimes. Are you sitting comfortably? Then we shall begin. Get in with a seamless count of four so I don't have to edit this later. Welcome, welcome, welcome. That's three already, so hang the expense. Four welcomes to Dan Sue, who has been passed the golden baton, I'm very delighted to say, by the wonderful, gifted performance poet Toby Thompson, who's been here before. And Toby has credited Dan as being a really significant mentor in his life. So it's my great, great pleasure to welcome Dan Sue, who is from Lyrics Organics, which he can tell us all about shortly. On your Bish Bash Bosh profile, you're a creative director, educator, event producer and poet. You're also a DJ and a dad, liking the alliteration there. And yes, welcome. It's really a joy to see you here in The Clearing.
Thank you for having me, Chris. I've been very much looking forward to this, and given the golden baton has been passed to me by a very dear friend, I'm honoured to be here. Thank you.
And if I may, if I could just blow a really happy bit of smoke at you, would you object to me just reading a little bit of what Toby said in positioning why it's lovely to talk to you?
Please do.
Dan has been providing me with opportunities to work and grow and believe in myself as an artist since I was a teenager. Many of my first ever gigs in London were programmed by him. As I know, I'm only one of countless people whose lives he's deeply impacted for the better. Your stage at Glastonbury, which is the Rum Shack, is legendary. And he talks about your son as rather beautifully complimentary. He says your son is a walking embodiment of the term beatific.
Wow.
Wow.
And that is an amazing happy smoke. I mean, it's funny listening to Kate Cross's interview, and she said that she loves sentences. She loves amazing sentences. And so it's no mistake that she picked Toby, because Toby is surely the most beautiful wordsmith and sentence maker I know. And so the fact that he managed to slide in what's the word again?
Beatific.
Beatific into the sentence about myself and my son. I'm very grateful. And it's really beautiful. I've known Toby, since he did a show with Akala's Hip Hop Shakespeare Company, and we were collaborating with Akala. I think it was like 2010. Toby was about 16 at the time. And it was just one of those moments that I get quite regularly, which is beautiful in my line of work, where I just am awestruck by a person and particularly their performance. And I feel very lucky in the line of work that I do, is that I get to kind of keep them. And Toby was very much like, he's in my sights now. I'm never going to let him go.
To
this day, we're still very, very good friends. And he's a tremendous artist as well.
Wonderful. So he was extremely welcome, as indeed are you. And this idea of passing the golden baton in order to keep the thread going is what's exciting about that construct, actually. So I wouldn't have met you if it wasn't for him, and I'm delighted at both. So, yes, if somebody doesn't have a frame of reference, and I'm going to ask you a deliberately clunky question just to get us on the open road. If somebody doesn't have a frame of reference, which we've had very deliciously about you, and they bump into you, know that you look and sound interesting, and they ask you, what do you do? What's your favourite way of answering or avoiding that question, Dan?
My favourite way is a convoluted version, which is I'm an educator and an event producer and creative director. I guess I'm a bit of a jack of all trades, which is slightly self-deprecating. But I find that my journey has been very much about dipping into communities and dipping into cultures. Mm-hmm. And I say dipping in like I'm just a tourist. Actually, I fully immerse myself in those spaces. But I also, and I'll explain a little bit more why later, kind of move in between different circles as well. Yeah, it's hard for me to pin down, but I say essentially I'm an educator, facilitator. I put on gigs from Glastonbury Festival to small open mic gigs. Yeah. And I make space is probably my tagline.
I like that. As a sort of conduit, an enabler and a mentor to many. And am I right in assuming you were one of the first people to give Ed Sheeran his first pop? Is it and Kate Tempest as well?
So Ed Sheeran, when he first came down to London, when he was about 15, 16, we were putting on a lot of shows around Kentish Town, Camden, with a friend of mine called Rada. And that was kind of one of my entry points into promoting live music. And myself and Ed became very good friends. Indeed, Lyrics Organics is very much founded on the intersection between spoken word, folk music and rap. Mm-hmm. An early Ed Sheeran, or indeed today's Ed Sheeran, is still very much in that kind of intersection of lyricism and acoustic music. And so Lyrics Organics, alongside other artists, people like Disraeli as well, are people who have really inspired and influenced what Lyrics Organics would become. Kay Tempest, we can take a bit less kind of influence in. Our first working with Kay was when we programmed them for the Rumshack at Glastonbury Festival. It was their first big music show on their first album. And it was an incredible show, also full of gremlins, but it was legendary nonetheless. And then we worked together for a few years. She invited Lyrics Organics to perform at Brighton Festival when they were the guest curator. We have been very lucky to fall into circles with people who have gone on to do great things.
Wonderful. And enabled and launched by you. I love the expression, full of gremlins, but legendary nevertheless. What a great, you're a great wordsmith yourself. Do you rap too? Because I know that you encourage a lot of rap music and you've influenced many career paths in that way.
Yeah, as a hobbyist, I've rapped. Like, lyricism and rap and hip-hop culture have been part of me since I was probably about 12, 13. I'm now in my 40s, so that's 3-4 decades worth of just lyrics. And so anyone who spent that amount of time would have written their own bars and performed. I started Lyrics Organics partly to surround myself with spoken word artists and rappers who I really admired, to get influence and inspiration that way. I do perform spoken word on occasion. I used to be a drum and bass MC. Again, I'll tell you more about that later. Lyrics, rap, poetry is really important to me. It's like a second skin.
Lovely. Delicious. That's a great segue then to getting us on the open road. It's my absolute joy to curate you through the journey and the construct of the Good Listening To show. It's going to be a clearing, a tree. You've been kind enough to, in a moment, to tell me what your clearing is. We're going to shake your tree to see which storytelling apples fall out. I even got a comedy prop apple. How do you like these apples? And then we're going to crunch along the apples of your answers to 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. 5 minutes to have thought about 4 things that have shaped you, 3 things that inspire you, 2 things that never fail to grab your attention. That's where the random squirrel will come in. There's also cake, a couple of squirrels, as I mentioned, a golden baton and a cake and some Shakespeare. It's all to play for.
Excellent. Can't wait.
So what is Where Is a Clearing for you, Dan Su, event promoter extraordinaire?
I had slight struggle answering this because my instinct answer is in a club, like in a nightclub, in a dark corner, with the focal point being the DJ. I feel really at peace there, either in a nightclub listening to kind of bass music, or in a live music gig. I just have this kind of moment of serenity where all of my best ideas come, and I know it's quite counterintuitive. However, I think for this, what I'm going to do is a little bit more traditional, which is when I go to find peace, because I don't know when I go to a gig whether it's actually going to be peaceful, you know, because it's also a place of work in many cases. So actually, when I try and find a level of peace, it's locally. I live in Southeast London. I live right around the corner from Sydenham Hill, Dulwich Woods, which is a beautiful ancient woodland. The last part that used to, there used to be the Great North Wood, which would stretch from Deptford near Greenwich all the way towards Streatham. And there would be a coppice there, and they'll use it for fuel. And then gradually it receded. And the last part of these woods is Dulwich Wood / Sydenham Hill Woods. And it's magical, it's peaceful, it's got history. And I just have a very profound connection with trees particularly. And I think it's partly because I grew up in London, and so I forgive the pun, I pine for green and nature, because I don't see very much of it. It's quite an alien concept for my London being to be surrounded by trees. And I'm lucky when I look out the back of my balcony at the moment, I have allotments. When I look out the front, I see treetops. So it feels like we're a little bit of a treehouse. And so, yeah, for me, my clearing would be Sydenham Hill Woods, or possibly Wales for similar reasons.
Lovely positioning. And rather excitingly, no one has yet said in the darkness of a nightclub as the one of the inceptions of their clearing. So I'm excited by both, but I take on board the Dulwich / Sydenham Woods. There we are, which is a perfect segue again. Thank you for bringing in a tree to shake your tree to see which storytelling apples fall out. So this is time to chunter on your apples, crunch along to four things that have shaped you, Dan, three things that inspire you, two things that never fail to grab your attention, la, la, la. You can shake them as you see fit. So how would you like to interpret that part of the exercise?
Okay, so let's go with the four things that shape me. I guess the most obvious thing is being British Chinese, and it's only something I've really realised what that means in the last few years, if I'm honest. So I was born in Edgware. My mum's from Singapore. My dad was from Hong Kong. They moved over in the 70s. My dad grew up in Nigeria, funnily enough. And Edgware is a very Jewish an immigrant community. In the 80s, when I was growing up there, it was very Jewish. I was surrounded by a Reform synagogue and I can't remember what the other type of synagogue was, but different kind of parts of the Jewish faith. And so I'd be sitting on a park bench at like Friday, Saturday, you know, smoking stuff that I probably shouldn't be. There'll be people on the Sabbath kind of walking past me. And that was a weird kind of contrast, and it in some ways it epitomizes this idea of me growing up in a space where I'm basically the only person who ever looks like me in my surrounding radius. And that could be whether I'm in the classroom at school, it could be whether I'm in a boardroom running a meeting, or if I'm leading workshops, or even DJing at a festival. Basically, and I've only realized this recently, I'm the only one who looks like me, generally. And so this has had a profound effect on what has shaped me, because I tend to move into cultures really feel them and work with them and be part of those communities, but also have that kind of independence to be able to move between them. So as an example, when I was at school, you know, there'll be the Sikh and the Hindu and the Muslim kids in one corner, there'll be the Jewish kids in another, and the Greek and Cypriots in another, and I was good friends with all of them, and I'd just kind of rotate between them. And one group would be like, why are you going to that group? Because they just didn't hang out. And I was the one who kind of could. And so I've always navigated life in a way which is about being authentic in different spaces.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Lowe's knows that saving is always top of mind, especially this season. That's why we've picked some great deals for early Black Friday. Get free select DeWalt, Cobalt, or Craftsman tools when you buy a select battery or combo kit. More tools? Why not? Plus, we've got select pre-lit artificial Christmas trees starting at $59.98 because it's never too early to think Christmas. Get Black Friday prices without the crowds. Lowe's, we help you save. While supplies last, selection varies by location.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
The station that makes you feel good.
That's so eloquently put, by the way. It's the idea of being a really wonderful, an outlier, but an inlier, because you're able to move seamlessly between all aspects.
Precisely. Yeah, exactly that. Being an outlier and an inlier. But this is really interesting because as we speak, times are changing very fast. You know, the government's predicted that there's about 300,000 immigrants from Hong Kong due on the BNO passports because of everything that's happening in China, effectively seeking asylum. There's a huge amount of influx of Chinese and Asian, East Asian immigrants at the moment for all kinds of reasons, the world economy, the job market, you know, standard of life, the relative cost of living for people from that part of the world. And so actually, with all of that said, this kind of 40-year-old kind of context, it's changing quite rapidly at the moment. I'm no longer the only person in the room. And that in itself is disconcerting for me. Because it's kind of upsetting what I've known of myself. So I'm kind of in this...
And if I may, is your cultural mix, is your partner Chinese by descent? And therefore, what is your son...
Good question. Yeah, no. So my partner is British. So she was born in Kent. So our child is mixed race, which is really interesting. If I'm honest, as a dad, I haven't fully processed what that means.
Yes.
Because
that's lovely because you've only just worked it out for yourself is what you're saying.
Yeah. And also because this has been controversial at points, but I've because of the virtue of my skin tone and the way that I work with other people, I've never seen race as necessarily the first kind of impression or barrier that other people see, because it's something I've overcome since I was basically 2 or 3 years old, when I would have to come into nursery and no one could pronounce my name, my surname, Sue. So I was told by my parents to tell everyone, your name is Daniel TSU. So I thought my surname was TSU. It was only until I went into school that I realised that my surname was actually Sue. And so, yeah.
You're in good company there. That's a bit T.S. Eliot, a bit TSU.
Yeah, exactly. And so, yeah, I'm just feeling it out at the moment. And it's interesting because having a mixed heritage child is a whole different kind of experience that I'm really looking forward to navigating in a way. So that's number one. Mm-hmm. Another thing that shapes me is London. Very much, I love London. Like, London is the soul of me. I love it. I also hate it at times. But to be precise, for me, London is encapsulated by pirate radio. I love the community adverts for hairdressers and fruit stores and, you know, really niche businesses. I love the idea of people scrambling on rooftops to put up aerials or take down aerials. I love mobile phone numbers being read out so people can ask for rewinds. Like, this whole culture, this whole tapestry of pirate radio is so alluring. I remember I used to have like an itchy trigger finger, but my trigger was a radio dial, and I knew that I could flick the radio dial with the exact amount of force to land between, for example, 96.9 and 99.3, and so on. And I don't know how I could do it because it was an analog dial, but I'd trained my brain and my ear so hard that pirate radio became a really important part of everything that I do. So it led me to MC culture.
I'm very happy for you, by the way. It didn't result in a side hustle of being an elite safe cracker. You're a frequency cracker instead.
Well, that was an ambition at one point, and then probably a bit of a dead-end career, to be fair, and especially when DAB came along. So MC culture kind of led me to drum and bass. I became a drum and bass MC for a number of years. That went really well. And then it took me to DJing, to putting on events. So it was kind of my entry point, but it also defined my music taste. UK garage, grime, reggae, dancehall, hip hop. And again, it all kind of feeds into this idea of these were music of other communities, but there was an identity for me that really made sense. As an outlier, it made sense that people were speaking of a struggle of race or a struggle of society in ways that I couldn't express or I didn't understand myself at the time. So London and pirate radio also really shapes how I read popular music or subcultures. You know, I can walk into a club or a festival and I can tell whether it's good or not. And I don't mean that in a subjective way. I mean in a relatively objective sense of being able to read a room and be able to understand the space and what's going well and what's not going well. And I guess it's kind of led me to where I am now.
It sounds like that's an acute ability to read an atmosphere in however one senses that.
Yeah, I guess it's kind of like a bit of a spidey sense I have, and it's been trained. I used to go to gigs like 6 or 7 nights a week because I got time out. Remember when time out was like £2.60 and you'd have every single thing happening in London in this
yes.
weekly magazine? And I remember looking through the listings and, you know, they'll have really weird words to describe a particular gig. And I didn't know who they were, but I was fascinated by the words that would describe the gig. So I would go to the gig and I would just find this whole world of stuff. And so, yeah, I guess I've trained this superpower just through osmosis more than anything.
And an awareness of what's maverick, different, unusual, or distinctly different.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess Lyrics Organic started because I knew I wanted to do something different from what I was seeing. And there was a gap that I wasn't experiencing that I felt like I could create. So yeah, that really kind of feeds into who I am. Mm-hmm. A third thing that shaped me was going to Sudan. I think it was 2015. I was doing some work at the mayor's office. I think it was Ken Livingston at the time. Actually, it might have even been Boris, but we did a show where we took over the whole of City Hall with a youth-led program. And one of the people I was working with, a guy called Dan Boyden, I'd never met before. We'd gotten really, really well in a short space of time, and he was putting in a proposal for British Council to do this thing in Sudan. Now, he does a lot of that kind of stuff. I'd never done anything like that overseas. And we knocked together a proposal, didn't really think anything of it. And then next thing we knew, we were on a plane to Sudan with two people who would become very good friends of mine, Deanna Roger, the poet, and a filmmaker called Fitzy. And we basically spent just over a week in Khartoum in Sudan working with 30 artivists, we call them. So artists who are also activists from Ethiopia, Sudan, and South Sudan. And it was a really profound experience for all of the obvious reasons, but also because it kind of broke through a bit of a glass ceiling for me of what I thought I could achieve. Mm-hmm. I remember sitting there on the first day being like, I don't know why I'm here or how I'm going to navigate this. I was there fundamentally to coach Arabic speaking poets and theatre artists, and I don't speak Arabic. And I had this moment where I sat down in the first workshop, I was like, I'm going to have to blag this. And then I was like, no, I don't have to blag this. Actually, I am surrounded by really positive people. And let me really see if I can apply that idea of reading a room or reading spaces or reading people. So I studied psychology at university in a different language and be able to interpret their performances, not understand the language, but understand what they're saying.
Through the cadence, I'm imagining.
The cadence, their body language, the reaction of other people to those pieces as well. And it all culminated in this big production that we created, that we produced, that took place in a 6-star hotel, which was owned by Colonel Gaddafi, weirdly. And it was it was one of the most profound experiences of my life. I still carry it to this day. I still speak to a lot of the participants today. And it actually kind of opened the door to me doing loads of British Council projects in the space of 5 years. I went to Cuba, Kazakhstan, Ukraine, Mexico, Russia, India, Georgia, all kinds of places, basically doing what I love, which is...
With the same squad each time or always different because you two got in with British Council?
Not with the same squad every time.
Yeah.
Often the ones that I've just mentioned, I would go on my own teaching events in emerging creative economies, which was really interesting. Like, how do you put on music events in a different paradigm, a place which may have a dictatorship and you can't say certain things, or in Cuba where you can't always get all the equipment that you need, or in Ukraine where previously one of the dominant languages was Russian, but depending on who you work with. So for example, if you work with younger people, they were more keen on using Ukrainian. If you work with older generation, they're more use Russian. And how you navigate those spaces. So it was different teams, different approaches.
So I'm hearing a bit of a people whisperer superpower in that you're reading environments differently and you're able to be the outlier, inlier, all very silky skills, actually, to be able to sort of move and navigate through quite a lot of distinct difference and differentiating environments.
Yeah, I think, I mean, this is probably the first time I've actually joined those dots in terms of being that person in the playground moving between different circles. And I think it, on a deeper level, there's probably something in finding validation originally. Who am I? Everyone looks different to me. Like, where do I fit in? But as time goes on, I have such an interest in people. People are amazing. I fundamentally believe that all people are beautiful, even people who you dislike or people who you don't get on with or who are, whatever. But somewhere deep inside them, there's a space where you can find common ground. And if you recognize that and you have the patience for it, you can kind of reach anybody. That's the idea. And then the fourth and final thing that shapes me is my 4-year-old son. Had a kid relatively late in the day, my late 30s, early 40s. And I guess the apart from how profound that was in an obvious way as a father, my dad passed away 10 days later and he never got to meet my son. So that gave me a lot of food for thought, as you can imagine. At the time, we were also on tour. So all of this was happening in the space of 2 weeks and my whole life was flipped upside down in a really positive way. I don't regret a thing. But it was really interesting. I've never had a massively close relationship with my parents. They didn't divorce or anything like that. A lot of families in my area, in my friendship group, divorced from early. So that was normal to me. But I actually had a relatively stable upbringing. But by virtue of the second generation immigrant relationship with parents, it can either go really well or not so well. More time, it was not so well. Certainly from my kind of teens, unsurprisingly. And so when my dad passed away, along with the usual, I'm a new father. What does it mean to be a father? Like, oh my God, I've got to behave now and like model behavior. It then gave me a lot of cause for thought about how my dad modeled behavior and things that he did that I just didn't even think about at the time. And you don't. Until something profound happened. So, yeah.
And do you mind me asking, was it a bolt out of the blue or was your father unwell and therefore you were sort of standing by for it?
It was a bit of both. Like he had, was it kidney disease? So he was on catheters and stuff for a while, but he was, I was told that he was improving, but I think it was around, no, it wasn't COVID times, it was 2018, but they were told that they couldn't really have visitors. So we couldn't really visit. And in that intervening time, he took a quick downturn and then passed away pretty suddenly. So it was in the sights, but it was quite unexpected timing.
Yes.
So yeah, those are the four things that shape me. Three things that inspire me. I'm going to start with Ai Weiwei. Ai Weiwei, the visual artist, the Chinese dissident who's kind of exiled and at various points has lived in Deptford, actually, in Oxford, all around the world, in Greece and wherever his art cause, is someone who, you know, for me is the highest example of what it means to bring together art and activism. And actually, we can swap this out with anyone who is prepared to sacrifice their freedom or their comfort levels for a higher purpose for other people, typically. And that, I find this tremendously inspiring, not least because, you know, Livex Organics and I do quite a lot. People look to us and are like, oh my God, you're doing this amazing thing. Well done for supporting this. But truth is, it never feels like you're doing enough. And actually, the inspiration I find the people around me who are doing amazing activism stuff. It could be the people who were teaching in the workshops who would end up on the front line of the revolution in Khartoum in Sudan in 2017, who then went on to be part of the civilian government. It could be people in Hong Kong who are my brethren, but I don't actually know. It could be people I know who are on the front line protesting against this government's policing bill, which has a tremendous impact on our freedom of speech. But for me, Ai Weiwei is brave. He's quiet, which is unusual. He's fearless. And also the way that he thinks compassionately, but also abstractively. Is that a word? I don't know. I'll ask Toby. In terms of the way he creates art that is influenced by such stuff and such experiences, I remember going to the Royal Academy to see his poles. I don't know how familiar you are with Ai Weiwei, but after an earthquake in China, he was like, I think this was his first major activism kind of project. And he was like, I need to go to this earthquake. I need to understand why all of these buildings, a little bit like what happened in Turkey, just collapsed. Like, no explanation. It shouldn't happen like that. Why did all these school children die? Anyway, he went there. He found that all of the supporting metal poles were not fit for purpose. He took all of them. He straightened them out, like hundreds, thousands of them. And then that became his artwork, which would sit in the middle of the Royal Academy. And just that thought process and that sensibility to turn something so graphic and painful into something that is so simple to understand and so artistic in its kind of presentation, it's incredibly inspiring.
And have you got a personal connection to him, or you just admire him from afar?
Just admired from afar, really. I mean, it's certainly amazing to see someone who has my skin colour doing that and being probably the best in the world at it. That's quite unusual. There's not many people who are lauded in the West of my skin tone up until the Oscars this year, where people put East and Southeast Asians on a pedestal. That's historically and culturally and racially, that doesn't happen. So the fact that Ai Weiwei cuts through all of that is tremendously inspiring. But no, there's no kind of personal kind of friendship there yet. Another thing that really inspires me is Glastonbury Festival, which is, I guess, slightly obvious. I'd been going to Glastonbury now for about 20, almost 25 years. I run a venue there called the Rumshack, which has now become quite infamous. It's a 1,000 capacity venue, which has had the likes of Kay Tempest and Mike Skinner, Akala, Koju Radical. It's a mix of DJs and live acts from all around the world. And Glastonbury inspires me because, and this is so hard to communicate to people who haven't been to Glastonbury, it actually becomes a bit of a cliche, to be honest, until you get there. But there's an authenticity and a truth and a spirit and a heritage to Glastonbury that you won't find not only in any other festival, but in any other event or indeed any other landmass anywhere else in the way that Glastonbury is. And it's hard to communicate this. You know, I teach event management to a lot of people, and frankly, because tickets are now 300 quid and it's so damn difficult to get tickets, people are like, I mean, why are you telling me about something I'm never going to go to? And I totally get it. And, you know, there's that danger of Glastonbury becoming increasingly elite for those reasons, and other reasons. But ultimately, it still retains a truth which is just irreplaceable and indescribable. And so
it almost sounds like a pilgrimage as well in your sort of DNA, if you like.
Yeah, and it's a pilgrimage for many people, and it has been a pilgrimage for many people over centuries because of Glastonbury Tor, and
yes,
you know, supposedly the Holy Grail is buried close to there, and Stonehenge is close to there, and so there is, and all the ley lines in the southwest converge at Glastonbury. So there are genuine.
There's that brilliant book called Mists of Avalon as well, which you may have read.
I know of it, but I haven't read it, sadly.
It's the Arthurian legend seen through women's eyes. It's fantastic, actually.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So having gone to Glastonbury for about 15 years, Lyrics Organics was doing, we decided when we started that we wanted to work with charities who we cared about, not just any charity. And long story short, we chose MSF, which is Médecins Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders. They're Swiss originally, but they're a humanitarian aid organization that sent medical care to the front line of places that don't have medical care, and they'll be the first one in and the last one out. And long story short, we started doing a lot of work with them, and they got invited to Glastonbury. And this kind of evolved into a bigger venue with programming. Ed Sheeran played his first Glastonbury there. We had loads of amazing artists. And just as a bit of a tangent, it was quite interesting because in 2010, Haiti had that terrible earthquake and then the cholera epidemic and killed about a quarter million people or more. And my partner now, who was actually working at MSF at the time, Joe, she designed a venue based on her field trip to Haiti, which was like a crumbling wreckage of a hospital in Haiti, and had a cholera tent inside. It had doctors and nurses and logisticians from the field to talk about their work. And it was, you know, it was, what's the word? It was pretty tough. It was a tough year. It was really rainy. You know, we were total newbies to it. But it eventually led to me running the Rumshack in 2013. And so I've never looked back since. So, yeah, that's been a tremendous influence to me.
As a seminal event curation, yes.
Yeah, I think it, culturally, it's still, you know, it's kind of waning a little bit, if I'm honest, like for all kinds of reasons, but it still retains that magic. So,
yes,
it's definitely an inspiration to me. And then the final one I'd say is, actually, friends doing extraordinary things is probably the thing that most inspires me. And it sounds a little bit cheesy, but I don't really put people on pedestals. And that's kind of why, you know, we've worked, or how we've worked with a lot of people who've gone on to become famous, because I don't really care about fame. Like, yes, to my own detriment, it's just not in my DNA. I'm not interested in egos whatsoever. So actually, you know, people like my friend Ben, who's got, you know, down in Margate, who got a startup brewery called Xylo, who's also, you know, has a kid with autism, that's inspiring. Like, yes. Deanna Roger, who I mentioned earlier, she's got two kids, she's a poet, she's had her poems read by Venus Serena Williams, or Venus Williams, excuse me,
or both, they're twins.
I think it was Venus. But also, you know, people just doing everyday things and getting through the end of the day, and with their head held high and still doing their job and making a difference. Those are the people that really mean a lot to me. You know, my grandma's lived in London for almost 40 years or 50 years, and she still can't speak English.
Is that your dad's mum?
Yeah, it's my dad's mum. She lives up in Harrow, and I'm amazed she still can't speak English. I mean, I still can't speak Chinese. I don't blame her. But the fact that she survived in this city for like all this time and just, you know, pretty much goes to the same supermarket, does the same thing, that's inspiring.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
We know what you're thinking. I just want jeans that look great, feel great, and hold up. At Ariat, we've been doing some thinking too. We're thinking about fit that moves with you, no matter where the ride takes you. Durability that stands up to hard work, harder play, and comfort that never quits. And all this thinking, it's really just about more living. Now, it's time to stop thinking and start shopping. Find your Ariat jeans at Ariat.com or a retailer near you.
If you love to travel, Capital One has a rewards credit card that's perfect for you. With the Capital One Venture X card, you earn unlimited double miles on everything you buy. Plus, you get premium benefits at a collection of luxury hotels when you book on Capital One Travel. And with Venture X, you get access to over 1,000 airport lounges worldwide. Open up a world of travel possibilities with the Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
And what happens linguistically with times with Granny if she doesn't speak? You'd...
Good question. It's pretty awkward, to be honest. Like, she speaks Pidgin English. I can't even speak Pidgin Chinese. It's difficult. It's difficult, and it's a source of frustration for me. We're thinking about teaching my kid at the moment Chinese, but there's not really any Cantonese school. He's technically Cantonese. Cantonese is a dying language. You know, it's a similar thing to Ukrainian. You have to fight for it. Like, it represents, it represents far more than the words. And, you know, in China, they're pretty much eradicating Cantonese out of the education system. But Mandarin is arguably far more useful and far more, you know, there's more Mandarin schools in the UK. So yeah, it's difficult. And it's, the irony is, having spent so much time, and maybe it's because I spend so much time in the language of music, and the language of performance, that I try and make up for my deficiencies in Chinese.
Yes. And now we're up to the two squirrels of distraction. What never fails to... Well, squirrels, and here is a squirrel for you. You're welcome, no extra charge. That always never fail to grab your attention, irrespective of anything else that's going on for you.
Sneakers. I can be really superficial sometimes. And I just love trainers. I'm a hip-hop kid by root. And I'm always like... You know, when you judge people in the first 8 seconds, like, I'm not looking at their face, I'm not looking at their clothes, I'm looking at their shoes. Like, my default kind of resting position is down, looking at people's shoes, because you can tell so much about them, like people's culture, people's identity, even to the point of not wanting to make people feel insecure about their shoes, because it really doesn't matter. But, you know, depending on how worn in a particular type of shoe is,
yes,
I can read quite a lot into that person. I think I can anyway. I might be totally wrong.
So you're not after the sort of Daily Crisp unboxed new pair. You're more about the sort of the history of the wearing that you're interested in.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, even then, like a box fresh pair says a lot about someone. But you can read more by, you know, a shoe that's got like a bit of a chip on the side or a broken heel or like a really, you know, I have a lot of, shoes that collectors would go wild over, but I've worn them to death and people would be like, I can't believe you've done that to that shoe. Do you know that shoe's now worth like a grand now? I'm like, I don't want to collect shoes. I want to wear the shoes.
And you'll be familiar with do you remember the Brian Keenan book, If I Lose My Shoes, I'll Never Get Out of Here, which was a hostage escape device. Whatever I do, I mustn't lose my shoes because that was the way of escaping. So stories that shoes tell, I get it completely.
But he didn't have to escape in the end, did he? He got freed, is that right?
Yes, but what kept him going was keeping an eye on his shoes because, I mean, that's what's so extraordinary. I mean, it just became something symbolic for his survival.
That's really interesting. I never thought of sneakers in terms of, you know, this is a very, very Western privilege thing to say, you know, sneakers is very much, well, not Western, actually, it's increasingly Eastern culture as well, but it's a wealth, you know, thing. You know, you have to be able to afford shoes and actually...
Just in the news in the last 2 days, there was the most money ever spent on the Jordan sneakers. If you know the trainers,
how much was it?
Well, now I'm going to catch myself at it. It's something loony, like 40. I'm going to say 40 million, but that might be too much. But it's an insane amount for shoes that have been worn and are probably a bit smelly. But who knows?
Actually, now that you say it, in answer to your question that you asked later about things I told myself younger, I wish I'd collected sneakers from young. Then I wouldn't even need a job right now. Do you know what I mean?
And forgive me, I'm going down a bit of my own rabbit hole. I use a bell to go cashier number 4, please, to get me. I went down a rabbit hole there. I'm sorry. So you've got a second squirrel now.
So the second squirrel is derelict buildings.
Ooh.
They hypnotize me. Like, as soon as I see one, that's it. Everything stops. I don't care if I'm on the way to a meeting, like if I'm in the middle of a conversation, I have to go to that building. And not often because like that building will be kind of embellished with street art or at least have, you know, perhaps history of squatting or like all of these kind of subcultures and countercultures and communities that converge on disused spaces. I think there's so much to kind of marvel at. I went to Lisbon last year with some of my boys and I did a street art tour because Lisbon's a bit of a mecca.
I love that, by the way. Some of my boys, that is your crew, by the sound of it. Your squad are
my
called
squad,
your boys.
Yeah, it was a real little squad out in. And so I was like, guys, I need to go to a street art tour. So I left all of them and I was like, listen, if you want to come, you're going to have an amazing time, but this is what I'm going to do. Come with me. My best mate came with me and we went to see this piece by Blue and Oz Jimios, who I think is a Brazilian muralist. And it was stunning. It was like this huge derelict building, brick top windows, and it was like a corner building. So it was like 3 or 4 stories and all of it was wraparound street art. And it was amazing, incredible. And then when I walked around the back, it was just a facade because the whole building behind it had been hollowed out, but you could still see like the kitchen shelves, the toilet, the wallpaper. And yet there was like trees growing out of it and animals through it. And, you know, there's something about this idea of stories and hidden stories and
in the fabric of a building. Yes. I love that.
Yeah. And the construct of it. Yeah. So that's my second school.
And now, a quirky or unusual fact about you, Dan Tzu, we couldn't possibly know until you tell us.
I almost died in Ethiopia.
Ooh.
I like getting myself into bit scrapes, like going on missions, on walks particularly. And I thought I would die in Ethiopia. I went to Lalibela in the north to go see it's a UNESCO heritage site where they have loads of rock hewn churches, so churches that are carved out of the rock, and some of them might be 2 or 3 stories high. And it was off season and I was staying in this hotel. I was the only one staying in this hotel. It was a really modest place, and they were really lovely, probably because I was the only like tourist in the village, basically. And I asked them to make me a little packed lunch so I could go for this walk. And bless them, they made me like this Pyrex glass bowl, like a big one of spaghetti bolognese. And I was like, that's really impractical for me going up this mountain. We were already like 2,000 feet up, and then it was about another, I don't know, whatever, 1,000 or 1,500. And I was like, okay, thanks. I'm definitely going to eat it, but...
Habsbag bowl will travel. I love that.
So... I mean, this is a much longer story, but essentially I started walking and I started picking up friends. And one friend was like a 7-year-old boy who wouldn't, you know, leave me. But we got on really well. And the subtext is that they want money, but this particular 7-year-old just wanted to hang out. And then inside a 12-year-old joined, and he did want money, and he was on the hustle, and I couldn't really lose him. And I basically had this pair, you know, we went through these kind of like aloe vera areas and these kind of eucalyptus forests, and eventually there was like this like a church in a cave, but you had to pay to get into this cave. And I was like, I can't be paying, and it's like something like $20 in northern Ethiopia. It was so expensive, and I was like, I can't, I've already seen 24 of these churches, I'm just not that into it. I'm not religious. I love churches as architectural buildings, but anyway. But I found out that there was like another route to the top of the mountain. There's stairs going through the church to the top, or you could walk around. And the kids were like, let's go around. It's fine. It's fine. It's fine. Anyway, I was like, are you sure? Maybe I should just pay this $20. I'll pay for you guys. It's fine. And then I was like, no, let's do it. Let's trust the kids. Like, it's theirs. They know this place. And we started climbing up this thing, and it became like the sheer vertical cliff face. And these guys were bounding up like, you know, gazelle. And I was on there, and I was looking down, and I was like, I'm in serious ish right now. Like, no one knows that I'm here. I can't climb. I've got a glass bowl of spaghetti bolognese weighing me down. And I'm not a climber. I'm not sure I'm going to make it. I can, you know, I'm getting vertigo. The whole thing was freaking me out. It's either the only way is up, basically. Eventually,
cue the music.
Faced my fears, got up, climbed the rock face. But there was a moment where I thought I would die in Ethiopia. And that's what I said to myself. But then it ended happily. When I got to the top, I had what I thought was my last cigarette. I shared the spaghetti bolognese with the two boys. So we were all eating with our hands out of this Pyrex dish. And then I was listening to my favorite reggae artist, Buju Banton, at the top of this mountain, which was probably cumulatively about 3,000 meters up. It was feet, meters, I can't remember. But anyway, it was
what an iconic day. I'm sure the two kids have never forgotten that day either, the sort of lunacy of eating spag bol from a Pyrex dish 3,000 meters up, all that. It's all great. I've
probably never even seen a Chinese guy either. So it was, the whole thing was just a bit bonkers.
No wonder they wanted to hang out. This isn't going to happen again. Great story, by the way. I wasn't sure whether it was the people that you picked up that were going to be the peril, or the actual epic quest that was the peril, but it was actually the vertigo that nearly killed you.
Yeah, quite. I mean, I'm not great. I'm not bad on heights, but this was, yeah, I could see very, very far and very, very down.
And now we've shaken your tree. Huzzah. Now we're going to stay in the clearing, move away from the tree. And we're talking about alchemy and gold now. When you're at purpose and in flow, Dan Sue, what are you absolutely happiest doing in what you're here to reveal to the world?
Yeah, thanks for asking this question. I really enjoyed thinking about it. I mean, I guess I never really considered what a flow state was until I saw Michael Jordan. So it's interesting you brought up Jordans earlier. Like, Michael Jordan was a hero to me. And really shaped what I thought humans could achieve. He's, you know, very superhuman. The idea that a person could fly. And at various points, I would have said, for me, my kind of flow state was MCing, rapping, like that feeling when you're in the pocket where you're nailing all of the beats and all the half beats, and you hit the drop and you... And sometimes you change your cadence or you change your flow because you know that lyric so well that suddenly you're adapting it to the beat. So you're essentially creating a song, but live. And that there's a real energy and a feeling to that I miss. I love being in the pocket. And because I would MC double time, so, you know, extra quick, because I was emceeing over drum and bass. When you hit the pocket, it feels like you are, you know, driving a Formula One car and hitting all the corners. Like, it's just amazing. And then eventually, like, that would turn into DJing. Like, when you're in the mix and you've got the perfect two tracks together and you've got this crowd who are loving what you're doing and they're waiting for your next mix and you know that this mix is going to kill it, but only you know what's going to happen next when it drops and you have the control over, you know, 1,000 people and their experience at that moment, that is an amazing flow state. But all that said, now I think I know that my flow state, my pocket, is being in the middle of the room as a facilitator, as an educator. You know, for example, in the roundhouse, in the hub, it's a 360 building, it's a 360 room right directly beneath the main stage in the kind of studio, creative studios for 18 to 25 year olds. It's all kind of old brickwork. It's really unusual. The acoustics are amazing. And just being able to control the space and control the experience and the kind of epiphanies, I guess, or the enlightenment or the learnings, at least, of young creatives and how that might shape them when things are just right. Like, there's no better feeling. And, you know, there's a lot of times when it isn't right, because there's so many factors at play. You might have a young person who's feeling particularly vulnerable. You may not have the right flip chart pen. You may not have thought properly about this exercise. Someone may have gone to the toilet, so you no longer have pairs. Like, there are so many factors, which means that when it does fit and you're in the pocket, like, it's indescribable. And when I've gotten better and better at this now, it happens more frequently.
It's such a lovely expression, by the way, in the pocket, as you're about to drop the beat, in the metaphor for both facilitation and in the throes of music. It was wonderful to listen to you vibe on that, actually.
Thanks. I mean, someone asked me what I meant by that the other day, actually one of my participants in the workshop.
And by the way, if I may, what was so wonderful and beautiful to observe is when you started talking about the beat and the music and dropping it, your dialect changed as well, because it became very much more street vibe, dropping the beat. It was lovely to watch.
Nice.
Just a subtle nuance of change of dialect, because that's somebody going into their zone of alchemy and gold. Fantastic.
Thanks. But I also, you know, I kind of get that same feeling as that workshop space at the Ramshack stage now. It took me a while. Like, there's a lot of, I've made all of the mistakes and, you know, so many things I look back on at the Ramshack with, we could have done that better.
You talked about gremlins, but still legendary. So that's how we learn, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I remember Kate Cross talking about, you know, failures and micro failures and macro failures and how important that is, because actually it's just a kind of consequence of risk.
Yes.
You can't have creativity without risk. And I think there's that, you know, the more mistakes that you make, the better you get at either how you feel about them when they happen and how you deal with them, or not making them again. And so Ramshack very much feels like that at the moment. We've hit that pocket. We're in a really good space at the moment. So I guess what I'm saying is, for the alchemy and gold, for all being said, it's about making space. I'm most at flow when I'm feel like I'm making space and sitting in that space.
In the pocket.
In the pocket.
And now I'm going to award you with a cake. So thanks for the wonderful alchemy and gold you've been given me by the bucket load in any case. But now it's my great pleasure to award you with a cake. You get to put a cherry on the cake now. This is stuff like, what's a favourite inspirational quote that's always given you succour and pulled you towards your future? And stuff like, what's the best piece of advice you've ever been given? Or what notes, help or advice might you offer to our younger version of yourself? So just riff as you like on that so far.
Okay. Where to go with this? I mean, the inspirational quote is an interesting one, because I don't remember quotes very easily. And actually, when I started to think about it, I started to think about me in the sense of, like, what shapes me, going back to what we're talking about. And so I'm going to choose Kano, the British rapper, his first single called P's and Q's. Now, this is by no means like a literary kind of, you know, model. But what it means and what it expresses means far more. You know, I remember when he was a 15, 16 year old kid, I read about him in Rewind magazine, this little free magazine about kind of urban music that you'd pick up in fashion shops. I used to write blogs on grime. And basically, Kano is probably the nearest thing I have to being a fanboy. But actually, as any fanboy would say, it's kind of more important than that. Like, because I'd always recognize that this was the guy who was going to elevate rap. Kano was the guy who was going to elevate rap. And coming from someone like me, that was a big statement to make. And I really doubled down on this. And I would talk about this for the best part of two decades. And now he is the crown jewel of the British rap scene. He is widely recognized as the best MC in the UK, perhaps ever. And for me, this is a lot of validation because Lyrics Organics is founded on that same belief that I had back then, either about Kano or Ed Sheeran or Carla, whoever it might be. And so anyway, this quote is from the second verse of his debut single, P's and Q's, in 2005. And I say 2005 for anyone listening to put this into context of where they remember grime was. Grime had kind of blown up post Dizzy Rascal, imploded because it had been, you know, kind of co-opted by record labels and, you know, commercialized, and then it effectively died a death. And so this single was very much kind of in its own lane, being like, no, this is where rap, British rap should be. And everyone else was doing this. And the second verse goes like this. And I should also mention, it always gets a pull up. It always gets a rewind. All you have to do is play the first seven words in any rave, it's destroyed. So it goes like this. I hate losing, so I ain't snoozing. From London to Luton, I'm moving. I'm even murking overseas, and I got it locked from London to Leeds. Please, from time you heard me shine. Now I'm big from London to Merseyside. You got lines, but you spit like nursery rhymes. This year's got to be mine. I'm the first in line. Wow. You got the first rewind, but the second line sounded like the first line. I ain't got punch lines. I got kick lines, and I ain't commercial, but I got hit lines. And therein, it's just, it's so densely packed at a time when people weren't using metaphors in the same way in grime. At the same time that people weren't recognizing places outside of London, when people weren't using double entendres in the music form, which is now very much commonplace, that really kind of propelled me towards my future in the sense of a belief of what I was doing made sense. And I wasn't the only one who thought like that.
I love that idea of the verse being the slingshot towards your future, but also he is now, as you say, ascended the hill, the king at the top. But what's so beautiful is you've gone right back to the first track, second verse, despite the canon of stuff that he's produced since.
Exactly. And do you know what? Like, I can't wait until he headlines the Pyramid Stage at Glastonbury Festival. And I've been saying this for 10 years, and I can't wait till it happens, because it is now almost guaranteed to happen at some point. He's now headlined the Park Stage. Anyway, I'm not going to go into details, but the point
is, do you have a personal connection to him whereby he goes, hi, Dan, and you go, hi?
No. We actually, not so long ago, I managed to get him to agree in principle, him and Stormzy, to a London youth education project under the Mayor of London's banner. But the bureaucracy of local government meant that it never actually happened, even though I had them like ready to go. And then, wow, Stormzy went like that, and Kano went like that. So no, as yet we've never been in the same room,
but you will yet. I love that, as yes. Yet wonderful.
But and then just to kind of go on with your piece of cake, I would say the best piece of advice I've ever been given was from my partner Joe, who goes by Joanna Layla. She's a fashion illustrator. She's, you know, the love of my life. She is baby mama, or 13, and we've been partners for 13 years. The piece of advice was that she encouraged me to quit my job and go full time with Lyrics Organics. I know it's the best piece of advice ever, because I've never even had to question it since. Like, it's never even been a doubt in my mind. And even more so because I was then able to support her to make the jump from MSF when she was working, and now she's flying high as a fashion illustrator. So yeah, that's
a cherry on the cake right there.
That's a cherry.
We're ramping up to Shakespeare in a moment, but just before we do that, this is the pass the golden baton, please moment. So who in your network, having now experienced this from within, would you, Dan, most like to pass the golden baton on to?
Well, I'm hoping they'll say yes, because I haven't spoken to them about it yet. But when I thought about this, I really wanted to be someone who I want to know more about. So I've chosen Renell Shaw. Renell Shaw, R-E-N-E-L-L, is one of the most incredibly talented musicians that I know. I happened to meet up with him recently. He tours with Rudimental. He's a bass player. He's a composer. He's a multi-instrumentalist. He's been an Ivor Novello award-winning composer. He's just directed, he was the musical director at Hackney Empire recently. He's worked with some of my favorite artists, Nile Rodgers, Skepta, Ayanna Witter-Johnson, Nitin Sawhney, Maverick Sabre. But that's not really why I thought he would be great for this. He's just a super interesting cat, really chilled, really calm. Every time I speak to him, I learn something new. I learned something about his background when I saw him the other week, in terms of what his dad did. I think his dad's a martial artist, and you know, that's kind of fed into his own discipline as a musician. So he's got a real Zen kind of grounding to him. He's a really beautiful soul, and also incredibly inspiring. Like, I have so much admiration for particularly people who are session musicians and people who aren't necessarily like the lead vocalist, because these are the people who are often working in service of other artists and making all the other artists look amazing. So yeah, Renell is a wonderful human being, a great soul, and one of the most talented humans I know.
What a great accolade, a super interesting cat, you said. That's just the most brilliant passing of the baton. What was his surname again? So sorry.
Shaw, S-H-A-W.
So your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to furnish me with the passing the golden baton, please. Huzzah! And now we arrive at Shakespeare, and inspired by all the world's stage and all the bedded women, merely players, Dan Su, event coordinator, facilitator, awesome pants personified, how, when all is said and done, would you most like to be remembered?
Wow, this is quite a big question, Chris. I mean, to be honest, I'm already seeing it. Like, the legacy... You know what I said just now about making space and sitting in it? Like, on a wider macro level, I'm sitting in that legacy. And that sounds quite wanky when I say it out loud. But what I mean is, one of my closest friends and inspirations, Natty Speaks, who's a youth worker, educator, Princess Trust ambassador, rapper, MC, host of the Rumshack, all kinds of things. He's always said to me, and he's the one who got me into education, to being an educator. And he always said, one day, bruv, our young people are going to be employing us. And I was like, okay, I don't know what that means or what that looks like. But there comes a point where you've worked with so many young artists and so many young creatives, and in many cases, you've left such an impression that I wouldn't normally say this out loud, Chris, but because I think it's worth saying that I regularly have young people come up to me being like, do you remember me, sir? Your workshop or your course is the reason I'm doing this job now. And that happens to me at least a couple of times a week. And if that happened to me once a year, I would have been like, whoa, that is... I'm really proud, and thank you for saying that. And now it happens regularly, and it doesn't get any less kind of saturated. It actually gives me more drive to do what I do and more momentum. You know, it could be people at bars, which is great because it means I paid less for drinks than I used to. It might be at festivals. It might be in boardrooms. It might be in workshops, and now they're facilitating the space and I'm assisting them. That's the legacy I want to leave, and I'm kind of in it already. And so actually the question is, like, how far do we take it? So that's something I'm really, really proud of. And yeah, I still struggle to grasp it, but in the same way as, you know, when an artist comes, like a musician might come off stage and people come up to be like, oh man. I mean, there's an element of superficiality to that kind of conversation. Maybe no more, no less. But, you know, that kind of the platitudes of being like, oh, your work's amazing. This album changed my life. Like, how do you receive that? As a creative, how do you receive that? Because almost inevitably, you never went out in order to have that objective. Normally you go out because you want to get something off your chest, or you have this creativity that you just want to share with the world. You never actually reflect on this idea that people are going to shine a mirror back on to it and project it to you. And this is a problem of mental health, where people like Amy Winehouse and any other number of musicians and creators struggle with that, especially in high profile creative pursuits. And so I get there's the kind of weirdness about it.
Although even in Toby Thompson's gifting of the baton to you, that's full circle too, because you are the enabler that opens the door to the music industry in what's been described. So it's no surprise that people are grateful for the person that went, hello, come in.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. It's just because I wish people did that for me. No one really did that for me. I had to find my own path, and I was just like, well, what if someone did that for me when I was 20 or even 30? Like, where would I be now? And it's not out of regrets. It is more out of, this is a power. Like, this hand that turns the doorknob, that opens the door, has a tremendous amount of power. And how you use that is what defines you, ultimately. So that's the legacy.
As this has been your moment in the sunshine of the Good Listening To show, stories of distinction and genius, Dan Chu, is there anything else you'd like to say?
Other than a quick plug, we've got this new project called Reset Gallery. You can find on Instagram called @ResetGallery00, which is a project we're doing with a festival in Mexico called Bajadora, which is a partnership with Glastonbury The Common, which is my field at Glastonbury. And it's looking at how people who create festivals and people within counterculture, so within the traveller community and so on, have the tools to build a better society in the context of climate change and our environmental emergency. It's basically digital micro talks, like 10-minute talks from people who are doing big things at Glastonbury and other festivals, festival founders, people who are pillars of the environmental sustainability movement, and just hearing from them, hearing their stories and how they've changed the world in small ways and how you might be able to do the same. So @ResetGallery00 is what we're working on next. And we've also got a show on at the Roundhouse called Desert Island Dub Plates. I'll leave to your imagination what that means, but it's pretty obvious. We've got Jordan Stevens from Vizzle Kicks. We're piloting this new kind of live podcast thing. Just follow us at Lyrics Organics, LYRIXORGANIX. Or if you want to follow me and all the weird stuff that I do, it's @OffYellowRadio.
Lovely. So, Dan Chu, thank you so much for being here in the Good Listening To show for a really awesome story of distinction and genius. Would you like to say anything else finally before I go, and good night?
Other than this has been a tremendous pleasure, Chris. Thank you for, you know, I love the fact that you leave this to the elements, and that you just, this golden baton idea is great. And the fact that it's just kind of, it's counterintuitive to my preciousness as an event curator, that you don't know who you're going to get next. And I love that, and I really value it. So thank you everyone that's listening. You're doing an amazing thing, Chris. Thank you.
Wonderful. So Dan Chu, thank you very much indeed. Tune in next time for more stories of distinction and genius. I've been Chris Grimes, but most importantly, that's been Dan Chu, and good night.
You've been listening to the Good Listening To show here on UK Health Radio with me, Chris Grimes. Oh, it's my son.
If you've enjoyed the show, then please do tune in next week to listen to more stories from The Clearing.
If you'd like to connect with me on LinkedIn, then please do so. There's also a dedicated Facebook group for the show too. You can contact me about the programme, or if you'd be interested in experiencing some personal impact coaching with me, care of my Level Up Your Impact programme, that's chris@secondcurve.uk. On Twitter and Instagram, it's
@thatchrisgrimes.
So until next time, from me, Chris Grimes, from UK Health Radio, and from Stan,
to your good health.
And goodbye. So, Dan, we've just had you giving your story of distinction and genius, your Dan Sue. Can I just get your immediate feedback? What was that like for you being within this structure?
I've really enjoyed the structure. It helps having a structure, especially to tell your life story. I think what's really great about this format is the space that you give to just tell innocuous stories. And I think I enjoyed the bits most where I got to tell stories that I don't normally do, i.e. that Ethiopia Lalibela story or being in the school playground. Like those are, you know, that kind of, yeah, I enjoyed the opportunity to, and the structure to tell some of the silly stuff really. And sneakers. I really enjoyed talking about sneakers.
That was great too. No, a real joy listening to you. Thank you very much. That was a gift to me too. I love the reciprocity that's implicit within what we've just experienced together.
Thank you.